Good morning to you. Welcome to the Oldmoor Variety Hour on KBOO in Portland. This is Norm Diamond, your host. Patricia Kohlberg is our producer. Tomorrow, December 18th, is International Migrants Day. So it's fitting that we devote one part of today's program to a man who came here from Ethiopia a few decades ago and whose murder by white nationalists 35 years ago last month was a watershed moment for Portland. Or was it? Did the death of Mulugeta Sirah make any difference at all in Portland's experience of and response to racism? But before we get there and to the rest of our program, our beloved radio station needs your help.
'Tis the season for giving, and before we get rolling, I want to remind you that KBOO is only on the air because of support from listeners like you. Please, if you can, go to kboo.fm/give and click on the donate button, or you can text KBOO to 44321, or click the donate button on your KBOO app. All of us at KBOO thank you for your generous support, which has kept community radio alive in Portland for 55 years.
Now would be a great time to contribute to the end of the year campaign, because a generous group of donors will match your gift, doubling its impact. Returning briefly to International Migrants Day, I want to think back to the original people, the first known to history or legend forced to leave their land of origin. You will probably not have guessed that I'm referring to Adam and Eve. Here's what Eduardo Galeano, dead serious, but with a light touch, had to say about some of the issues in forced immigration. Galeano was himself forced into exile for a big part of his life. His focus here is on gender. So this is Galeano. According to the official version, Eve tempted Adam. She offered him the forbidden fruit, and it was her fault that both of them were banished from paradise. But is that how it happened? Or did Adam do what he did of his own accord? Maybe Eve offered him nothing and asked nothing of him. Maybe Adam chose to bite the forbidden fruit when he learned that Eve had already done so. Maybe she had already lost the privilege of immortality, and Adam opted to share her damnation. So he became mortal, but not alone. That was from Eduardo Galeano. Another dimension of the migrant experience is the reception in the place migration goes to, which in our world squarely raises the issue of racism. That will be the focus of the second half of our program. First up is the threat of nuclear weaponry. A major international meeting at the United Nations on that subject just concluded, actually promising some glimmers of hope. John Hocken, an old mole and filmmaker who has worked extensively on nuclear power and environmental issues, here talks with Julianne Hauschultz, who participated in that conference. Jan?
Welcome to KBOO, Julianne Hauschultz.
Hello, thanks for the invitation.
Well, you are active in the German section of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, ICAN, and you're a campaigner for nuclear disarmament at the German section of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, IPPNW. So we are so delighted to have you join us today to talk about the second meeting of states parties at the United Nations during the end of November through December 1st, where you were an attendee. First, can you set the stage for us? What was the scene and what was the significance of this international meeting, the first of which was held in 2022?
Of course. So the second meeting of states parties of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, so it's a real long name, and this conference that was just held in New York City is at the moment, I would say, the only forum where nuclear disarmament is discussed internationally, because this treaty is the first treaty that bans nuclear weapons internationally. It is only legally binding to its member states, but that's why these member states meet at these conferences to discuss how exactly they want to achieve nuclear disarmament and how they want to achieve all the obligations, the negative and the positive obligations of this treaty. The treaty forbids all kinds of activities around nuclear weapons. So, of course, to deploy nuclear weapons, but also to station them, to manufacture them, et cetera, et cetera.
So the et ceteras are more than in the past, as I understand it. This treaty now is broader than in the past. Is that correct? Because these treaties and campaigns go back to the 1960s.
Yes, that's right. And it is the first treaty that comprehensively bans all these activities. Because before there were smaller treaties, for example, bilateral treaties on nuclear arms control or also nuclear disarmament. But on the international multilateral forum, there was mainly the NPT, which is the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And although there is an article, Article 6, that says that the current nuclear weapon states have to negotiate in good faith to disarm, they didn't do so yet. So that's where the ban treaty steps in and says, okay, we have to do something.
Yeah, I'd like you to just say a bit more to emphasize that point, because often the rhetoric around this gets confusing. There's non-proliferation, there are limits on the types of nuclear weapons that may develop, but a ban is a different level of anti-nuclear activity, right? Say a bit more about these distinctions.
So on the current treaties, we have the non-proliferation. So basically to say that right now there are certain states that have nuclear weapons, but we don't want to have any other state to have nuclear weapons. So that's proliferation or non-proliferation. And then we have arms control. I think many people would know the treaties from the Cold War era, where especially the US and the back then Soviet Union decided that they will not stockpile more weapons, for example. So they had these arms control treaties. And there were some disarmament treaties, so to actually reduce the number of nuclear weapons. But right now, with the TPNW, this new treaty, it's only now in January 3 years old. So with this new treaty, nuclear weapons are banned. So they are completely forbidden. And the goal of the treaty is a global zero in the end.
Abolishing them.
Exactly, abolishing them.
So can you also, without listing the countries, the members, and those who are not members or observers, can you describe the geographical demographics of members and where the greatest support and opposition lies?
Well, with the ban treaty, it's kind of obvious that all the members currently are non-nuclear weapon states. Most states are located in the so-called global south of the world, a lot of African states, Latin American states, also Asian states. Right now there are 69 member states and I think 92 signatories. I'm not quite sure about the second. And the opponents are basically the global north, especially the NATO states, the nuclear weapon states, and with the NATO states, of course, also nuclear sharing states like Germany, where I come from.
So what is the strategy for taking on these powerful countries that possess nuclear weapons and are opposed to bans for obvious reasons, or there perhaps are multiple reasons? There are five or six countries, and Israel makes six, right, that are nuclear powers. Can you list them?
So altogether we have nine nuclear weapon states.
Nine now.
Yeah, it's five official nuclear weapon states, like official under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The United States, it's Russia, France, Great Britain, China, Those are the so-called official nuclear weapon states. And then we have Israel, we have North Korea, we have Pakistan, and we have India. And of course, they're all not part of the Ban Treaty. Otherwise, they wouldn't be nuclear weapon states anymore. And the approach of the treaty to get these states on board, well, at the moment, it is quite hard, I have to admit. I think the main goal is to have as many states as possible within that treaty to actually say, okay, the majority of states, the majority of people in the world are against nuclear weapons and want them to be banned, want them to be abolished. So to raise the political pressure internationally on these states to actually do something about their arsenals. And also there are the so-called positive obligations of the Ban Treaty. That means victim assistance and environmental remediation. So to say, okay, we already have victims of nuclear weapons, and that's not only in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but worldwide by nuclear weapons tests, for example. And the treaty wants to raise support for these people. And I would say that's a really good pathway towards also regarding the nuclear weapon states, or probably not them, but at least their allies. So for example, Germany as an ally, as a nuclear sharing state, is observing these meetings, and they're actually engaging in victim assistance, or they're just about to start to do so. But so they recognize that nuclear weapons are harming people, are harming the environment. And I would say that's a good step towards to probably not get them on board for the treaty yet, but to have them on board to say, okay, there are actual humanitarian consequences and we have to deal with them right now at the moment.
Can you list some of those and how nuclear weapons are a climate justice or environmental justice issue?
List of some of the test areas?
Well, how these particularly impact indigenous communities, certainly in the U.S. and around the world. So I think often nuclear proliferation, like nuclear power, are separated off from other environmental issues or climate justice issues.
During the nuclear weapons tests, especially during the atmospheric tests, often portrayed as if those were so-called empty spaces. I think we saw that, for example, in the new Oppenheimer movie by Nolan. So they ride along this like New Mexico, this empty lands and nothing here. But actually there were people, and these people were harmed by nuclear weapons, not insofar as they died because of the explosion, but of course of the radiation, because there was fallout in the area, but also in wider areas. And this caused medical consequences like cancer, for example, like miscarriages, like related mental health issues. There were higher suicide rates, for example, in the Soviet Union. They tested, for example, in Semipolatinsk, and the region had the highest suicide rate because of also other medical preconditions. Also because the land is completely contaminated. And for example, when we see the Marshall Islands, or Kiribati, French Polynesia, other testing areas, people were really dependent on their own agriculture, for example, or on fishing. So with the radiation, the land got contaminated, the water got contaminated, so people couldn't use the traditional, or couldn't continue with the traditional living anymore.
This is an ongoing issue.
Yeah, of course, that is ongoing, because there was no so-called environmental remediation yet. So there was no cleanup whatsoever. So people are still facing this.
What is the extent of testing of nuclear weapons now versus in the past, where most of this, as I understand it, went underground? And so there are claims that the effects of testing, the health consequences, can be more controlled.
So I would say there are three stages. There were the atmospheric tests. And then they went underground, and underground, of course, it's still polluted the area, and also especially also on the atolls, so these islands where they tested, the material is really porous. I don't know, like it's really easy to break. So especially on the islands where they tested, the underground is not made for this test. So the underground is contaminated at the moment. and there is a risk for it to break open because it was shaken and it's not solid enough to hold that.
Do participants at the meeting or organizations that support a nuclear weapons ban take up reparations around nuclear testing?
Yes, they do. The thing is that at the first meeting of state parties that you mentioned in 2022 in Vienna, they wrote the so-called Vienna Action Plan. And I would say this meeting right now was a little bit like a work in progress meeting to see where we are at the moment. And between these two meetings, there was the so-called intersessional process. So the states are not only meeting during these meetings, but also in between in working groups. And there is one that is especially designated to see how one can actually assist victims and the environment. And they plan, for example, on an international trust fund to assist people, but it's not set yet. So they're discussing the means and the instruments they want to implement. There is the hope that they will implement them on the next meeting, which would be in 2025. But of course, it's the state negotiations that take their time, and they have to see like how exactly one do we want to design this fund, who exactly can participate, how do we decide on distributing the money that gets in there. So they're talking about this at the moment.
Is that important in the organizing around Ban the Bomb, you know, which goes far back to the 1950s? I remember as a child, seeing Ban the Bomb posters and pins, and the I think the campaigns around it and the strategies, including rhetorical strategies and political strategies, have changed over time. Do you think that's important, this part of the work that you're describing now, showing that it's not only whether or not nuclear weapons are used again after the horrors of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, but that this is an ongoing destructive practice of militaries?
I would say yes, it is. I would not say probably that it's so completely new, because there was this Nevada semi-politics movement that was also about the victims of nuclear testing in Nevada and in semi-politics in the Soviet Union. So I would say there are also roots of this in the like really long and old tradition of this movement. But I would say yes, it came up recently again, also with the treaty having this positive obligations. Well, right now that my really like Western European German perspective. But I would say that it's a really good entry point, for example, for lobbying, because in Germany, especially at the moment, we have a lot of young members in the parliament. And so I was born after the Cold War, and many people are at the parliament as well at the moment. So for us, this fear of a nuclear war is probably not as present anymore as some older members.
Right. You don't have the gut level shudder
reaction. Exactly.
You growing up and hiding under our school desk.
Exactly. You know? And I mean, that's a good thing. I mean, I'm glad that I don't, but I think it changes the movement a little bit. Right. And I would say that the survivor's perspective is really important in that part, because my generation, we were brought up with these ideas of feminism, of post-colonialism. So we have these new ideas that were always kind of there in the movement, but I think we have a different perspective on them, or they're more important to us probably. And so when I talk to parliamentarians, I see that especially the younger ones are more interested in this nuclear survivors perspective, and are like, oh, okay, I didn't know. That's something I hear. Like, I didn't know that there were these tests, that there are people affected. So you have another entry point, I would say. And I would say that's really important. And especially in countries like Germany, where we, due to so-called NATO obligations and the political pressure that is put on the government, on the parliamentarians, not to question nuclear sharing, not to question nuclear weapons, it is a point where you can say, okay, but even underneath this, even though we do not agree on that, can we talk about how to assist victims? Can we talk about how to help them with their environmental problems?
And the report that came out of the meeting also declares a commitment to women, the participation of women, and gender as an aspect of the work and the impacts of nuclear proliferation. Can you say a bit about that? How gender shaped even these more recent meetings?
And my really first initial thought was, yeah, I do see a lot of more women here, and I hear a lot of more women talking than I ever had on the NPTs, so the Non-Proliferation Treaty conferences. So I would say there are more women participating, more women are actually talking up. And so regarding the consequences and why it is a topic on the conferences is because radiation affects female bodies other than male bodies. And we don't know yet why. We know that women and especially girls are more likely to get cancer due to radiation, for example. And there is no or not enough research on the reasons for that. And the treaty wants to look into that, because the assistance should also be adapted to gender, for example, and to it differs between younger and older people, right, as well. So they really try to get into these dimensions as well.
Before we close, I also wanted to ask you to say a bit about the relationship between nuclear power, nuclear energy, and nuclear weapons, because, of course, nuclear power became the redemptive story in the U.S. for justifying these horrific weapons, and remains linked to the military and nuclear weapons. And I understand why these nine countries that possess nuclear weapons resist talking about or confronting that association. But how are you dealing with that with your organizations in Germany and elsewhere, the links between nuclear power and nuclear weapons? Can you just say briefly?
I have to say that that's more like the IPPNW take on the issue, and not of the State Parties Conference, because the Parties Conference is only nuclear weapons.
So but the international, just to repeat, International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, IPPNW, where
exactly.
You're a member, that you can't speak for your organization
exactly,
on that
exactly.
point.
And we are working on both topics, because for us it is linked. And if we see, for example, the source of both, which is uranium mining, which already inflicts a lot of pollution, a lot of contamination, a lot of humanitarian consequences already. And if you have Fukushima, Chernobyl, so all the big accidents that we know about, Three Mile Island, there were huge consequences of this. So I would say nuclear power is never safe, and it's always a danger, be it in nuclear power plants or in nuclear weapons. I mean, nuclear power plants were kind of a byproduct of nuclear weapons production. So there was first the military use and then the civil use. So it's just inherently connected to each other.
And we see that in war zones now as well.
Exactly, exactly. In Zaporizhia, for example, we just, like, the states cannot agree on a demilitarized zone around Zaporizhia in Ukraine. So there is also danger of nuclear power plants in war zones, in conflict zones, exactly.
Well, Giuliani Hauschultz, how can we find out more about your work before we close today? Can you say a bit about how listeners can become more involved, and particularly as it is part of a broader anti-war movement or social justice, anti-colonial movements? How can we find out more about your work or other work you find meaningful?
I would say about my work, that would be on the website of the IPPNW, ippnw.org, which is the international IPPNW, and there everything is in English. There's also an American section of IPPNW, and also ICANN, so that is ICANNW.org. That's the international website of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, which is a huge campaign, and IPPNW is also part of this campaign. And I would say for people who are interested in the whole nuclear weapons topic, I would definitely recommend the website of ICAN.
Well, we'll include some of those sites on our KBOO website on the Old Mole Variety Hour. And once again, Giuliani Hauschultz, thank you so much for being with us today and for your important work. I hope to bring you on to the show again.
Thank you. That would be really nice. I would love to.
Thank you, Jan Hocken and Julianne Hauschultz. Once again, we hear from Patricia.
This is Patricia Kohlberg of the Old Mole Variety Hour, briefly interrupting our show to ask you a question. Did you know that one of the oldest surviving community radio stations in the U.S. is right here in Portland? KBOO has thrived over the years because of support from listeners like you. Please, if you can, go to kboo.fm/give and click on the donate button. Or you can text KBOO to 44321 or click the donate button on your KBOO app. Now, back to the programming that you will not hear on commercial radio.
Remember, what Patricia didn't tell you, any amount you're able to give, up to $20,000, will be matched by a generous group of donors. Now, a question for you. Is racism un-Oregonian? That's what a former governor claimed at a big public rally addressing the murder of Mulugeta Sirá by racist skinheads 35 years ago. Eleanor Langer knew different. Her book, 100 Little Hitlers, The Death of a Black Man, The Trial of a White Racist, and the Rise of the Neo-Nazi Movement in America, came out 20 years ago. We began our conversation as a sort of commemoration on the 35th anniversary of the murder. This is Norm Diamond. 35 years ago this November, on Southeast 31st Avenue, it was just off the western edge of Laurelhurst Park, an Ethiopian immigrant was killed in a late-night street fight by homegrown Portland racists. For those of our listeners who were around then, the name of the man killed, Mulugeta Sirá, still resonates. We'll have more on Mulugeta Sirá as a person later in the program. The men who killed him identified as skinheads and were members of a group they called East Side White Pride. Their plea bargained conviction was followed by a trial in Portland, charging a California group, White Aryan Resistance, and its leader, Tom Metzger, with having instigated and being responsible for the murder. 20 years ago, Eleanor Langer published a deeply researched and controversial book on these events. She called it 100 Little Hitlers, The Death of a Black Man, The Trial of a White Racist, and The Rise of the Neo-Nazi Movement in America. I hope I got that right, Eleanor. Fortunate and excited to have Eleanor Langer with us to reflect on the meaning of those events. Welcome, Eleanor.
Thank you. I am very glad to be here talking with you about this.
You spent years researching and writing your book. One of its signal accomplishments is your portrayal of these people who held abhorrent ideas and committed despicable acts. At some level, you humanize them in the book. As readers, we get to know them as real people and not simply villains, abstractions, or symbols. How did you do that? And why do you think that's important?
The three skinheads who were who pled guilty and were guilty of the killing, well, one technically guilty of the killing, were very local people. I mean, very local in my Southeast Portland life or my Portland life. One was a neighbor, in effect, who lived a few blocks away in Selwood. Another was the homecoming king of Grant High School, where I had friends who had children who knew him. And the third, the actual killer, Ken Miskey, was a figure in the countercultural scene, rock scene and other, but with overlaps with people who I knew from my life here. And originally, my plan was to cover the trial, but there was no trial because they pled guilty. There was no trial of that. There was no criminal trial ever. They pled guilty. By that time, I had learned enough about them and where they came from and were coming from to propose. I had been going to cover the trial for the nation, but by that time I learned that they were really an outpost or a manifestation of something that was happening nationwide, if not worldwide. And that became a special issue of The Nation published in 1990 called The American Neo-Nazi Movement Today, which was a first look at the rebirth, you might say, of Nazism and neo-Nazism in the U.S. In the post-World War II years. In the period of writing about the local scene, I was eventually befriended by the mother of one of the skinheads, Kyle Brewster, who, after long pause and much consideration, agreed to introduce me to some of the people that Kyle knew from high school. And I invited them over to my house, and we sat around my table and we talked, and they told me about Kyle, and they told me about those Portland, the music scene. And honestly, Norm, they were so human that they were so polite. They sat around the table and we talked, and they used words like compassion. And we were eating pound cake. They cleared their cake plates and said, "Thank you, ma'am," when it was over. I said to myself, you know, these kids have mothers. You know, they were brought up. They have mothers. They're real. And after that, I was really never able to see them as other than real. It doesn't strike me now that there's something that one should have to apologize for, but yet you do, not only in this instance, but in any other instance where you're humanizing, quote, the enemy. I mean, the fact is they're human. So what do you do with that?
And you can't understand really what shaped people, why they became how they did, unless you see them as human beings also. And that's a major part of your book, is enabling us to understand these people who, again, did awful things.
Mm-hmm. Did and thought and think awful things. And their counterparts today are continuing to do and think them, but that doesn't make them any less human. It's odd in a way that should be such a controversial point, and yet it is, as we know that it is.
Well, I'm going to cite it as an absolute merit of the work that you did.
Thank you.
And you're right, that there's continuity with what's going on today, of course. Mm-hmm. You wrote, at a time that you wrote, it was a seemingly new or a somewhat new manifestation of racism, this neo-Nazism. You mentioned that it was national even, but your focus was on its presence in Portland and its mm-hmm. seeming newness to us. Just a reminder, this was in the context of struggles here in Portland over segregated schools. I recall overt acts of racism by the Portland police, mm-hmm. like throwing dead possums at the doors of a Black-owned business.
Right.
One of the most striking aspects of 100 Little Hitlers, of your book, is how the plea bargaining of the charges that resulted in convictions for the skinheads and the guilty verdict, we haven't come to this yet, in the trial of the WAR people, the white Aryan resistance people from California, enabled a sort of denialism in Portland about the existence of racism here. It's an odd outcome, but it's, I think, really worth emphasizing. And that's another major merit of the work that you've done. Tell us about that denialism.
I think that's such an important point, Norm. And I think it operated on a lot of levels. I think initially, when the focus was still local on the death of Seurat, there was a liberal outcry. There was a public outcry. There was a huge rally actually in Pioneer Square. One of the things that stands out in my mind from it was one of the speakers, a former governor, Barbara Roberts, who's not, I mean, she's not active politically anymore, but I remember her thundering to this crowd, "Racism is un-Oregonian." Your mind has to stop at a statement like that when we know so well otherwise now. We partly know so otherwise through the initial work of a man who really deserves, absolutely deserves mention in this conversation, is Darrell Milner, who was a professor of Black Studies at Portland State and who documented the possum incident that you're talking about and the school segregation, the busing and school segregation issues. And actually, I have to say, made those files available to me and documented and brought to light the history of exclusion of Blacks in the Oregon Constitution, which honestly, I don't think anybody had talked about until that time. I mean, it was there, but it was his work. And also importantly, the movement, the anti-racist movement that grew out of the killing of Surratt, a vast and really significant countercultural movement, the Coalition for Human Dignity and anti-racist skinheads and sharps, skinheads against racial prejudice. Many gay and lesbian participants and various organizations, they knew better what the history was, and more, they knew what it was like to try to oppose these neo-Nazi skinheads on the street. Because I guess we have to back up these racist skinheads who had just burgeoned in the 80s were taking over the clubs, the music clubs, and the streets to some extent. And it's only, my opinion, it's really only the Coalition for Human Dignity, and I mean that to include everybody, not just technically the members of the CHD, who understood what was going on. They did not get support from the powers that be in the city. And in fact, they were themselves treated as another problematic gang. But in any case, they saw the racism firsthand. So the statement, you know, racism is un-Oregonian, it would be laughable if it weren't so awful, really, and so misleading. But I think what you were heading toward, and rightly, is that this denial, public or denial from the top, absolutely culminated in the civil trial of Tom Metzger by the Southern Poverty Law Center, which happened a few years later, where Metzger, as you say, from the white Aryan resistance in California, was deemed responsible, legally responsible, for the killing of Mulla Getta Serao, which was, and I believe still is, the best out that a city could possibly have gotten, that Oregon could possibly have gotten for its racist history, because there you have this perfect demonic, so to speak, outside agitator convicted for the killing of Seurat, which even the skinheads that I knew, the racist skinheads themselves, would say, no, he wasn't the one responsible. We grew this. They were proud of it. We became racist on our own. We saw the world around us, and this is what we made of it. We made these contacts. We reached out. They quite resented that they were thought to be tools of this guy from California.
Seeing them as tools, seeing Californians as outside agitators responsible, of course, is a way of relieving responsibility for Portlanders and for Portland.
Absolutely. That is so true.
It reminds me, I don't think I've mentioned this to you in our preliminary conversation, but it reminds me of just the folks after the French Revolution occurred who wrote denying that it ever could have happened. There were theoreticians, very prominent theoreticians, and the fact that the revolution had happened just didn't fit their preconceptions about their society. And so they simply wrote, it had not happened. And we see that kind of denialism about climate change, about all kinds of things. It's a way of pushing off responsibility.
It is.
So I understand the racism, the divisiveness and hatred, the aimlessness of the young people's lives that you go into so well. I understand all that as a function of the social economic order that was hardening in the 1980s. So to me, And I want your reaction to this. To me, it's ironic then that it was a capitalist profiteering organization that took Tom Metzger and the WAR, the White Aryan Resistance, that took them down. Just for our listeners, this was a civil, you mentioned this earlier, was not a criminal trial. One of the most controversial aspects of your book, as I remember back then, is your treatment of the SPLC, the Southern Poverty Law Center. Those folks did not much like your treatment of them, did they?
No, they didn't. The SPLC was a very powerful organization in the civil rights arena. It started in the 1970s and grew partly through very successful and important and you know, in many cases, valid, probably in most cases, valid lawsuits. But it was also, it's got to have been one of the most successful fundraising organizations ever born, ever created in the U.S. And I guess I should say I think it's past its prime. I think they've had their own internal struggles in recent years, as I gather, and they're not powerful the way they were, but they had powerful friends in powerful places in journalism and in Congress and in Hollywood and every place that you need powerful places in this country, and could control and did control in the Metzger case the interpretation that was left. That seems to me problematic and sad for two reasons. One, in the case of Metzger, they successfully substituted this narrative, to use the word everybody's using these days, of the outside agitator for the Portland racist skinhead movement, which was part of the denial, part of the out that you're talking about. But also, sadly, they got so much money from people who couldn't afford to give them money, who believed that it was a useful way to spend their money. And they actually often would feature these stories in their magazine. And they were sad because they were illusory, good-willed people who wanted to fight racism, thought they were doing it, and it wasn't accomplishing what they thought. And another consequence of the Metzger trial, which is misleading beyond Portland, is the belief that it accomplished something in terms of the white supremacy movement. But we can see now, unfortunately, all too clearly, that it didn't. So therefore, their claims, not only that Metzger caused this Portland incident, but putting him away isn't the right phrase, but they bankrupted him. By bankrupting him would have some effect on the course of the movement, and it absolutely did not. In fact, you could argue that it publicized it more. Now, I had this quotation that I, let me read it.
Yeah.
This is Tom Metzger on the steps of the courthouse here in Portland after the trial. He says, "The movement will not be stopped in the puny town of Portland. We're in too deep. We're in your armies. We're in your police forces. We're in your technical areas. Where do you think a lot of the skinheads disappeared to? They grew their hair out, went to college. I just did my little bit along the way, like your great salmon. I got up there and laid the eggs, and now if I die, no problem." I think that is an entirely accurate assessment of his role and what's happened since. I mean, he did die in 2020, and he hadn't been that active for a while, but look at it now. Look at what we're seeing now.
I remember that quote.
Yeah.
And yes, that's one of the reasons we're talking, of course, is there is real continuity with what we're up against now. My guest has been Elinor Langer, author of 100 Little Hitlers, The Death of a Black Man, The Trial of a White Racist, and The Rise of the Neo-Nazi Movement in America. Elinor and I chose November 13th to begin our conversation on this history that date marking the 35th anniversary of Mulugeta Serra's murder. Just a reminder, if you walk the neighborhoods around Southeast 31st and Pine and look closely, you'll find memorials and recognitions for Mulugeta. I'm going to give you the last word, Eleanor. There's something you want to reinforce. And thank you very much for joining us. We're going to return in a moment with Eleanor bringing us her own recognition of Mulugeta Serra. But any last words?
Well, first, thank you. It seems good and important to be able to air some of these things. I would just want to remind people how different, actually, the city, and not the city, the world was in 1988. Remind people that what we're looking at when we look at 1988 is a world without cell phones and without social media. And so, and this movement spread person to person contact, in reaching out in a very grassroots way. So it seemed very big at the time because they got a lot of publicity. The skinheads, and partly through Metzger's auspices, were on Oprah and they were on Geraldo, Donahue, everybody else who was around then. But it was still very small and narrow compared to what we see now when it's in your ear, it's all the time. It's such a vaster phenomenon now, a vaster reality. What I wonder myself, it's a last question, is how much difference does it make in the spread of this in throughout society, what the people at the top stand for, or how they react, or what they believe? That there seems so fragile opposition at the top now to the spread of this. And indeed, you know, in the Trump case, we have the opposite. That's beyond denial. This phenomenon of denial is one level, but acceleration or endorsement is another.
Encouragement, yes.
And I don't know where this country is now in that trajectory. And the one other thing that I would say, I did really want to refer your listeners to a recent book called It Did Happen Here, put out by some of your KBOO colleagues or associates, based on their podcast by the same name. And anyone interested in what the scene was in 1988 and what its implications are should really find and read It Did, or listen to It Did Happen Here, an extraordinary anti-fascist, rightly named anti-fascist history.
And that book from PM Press.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Eleanor. We'll be right back again with Eleanor's own words from the Oregon Encyclopedia on Mulugeta Serra. Before we listen to Eleanor Langer's appreciation of Mulugeta Serra, I want to note that 35 years ago, it was this radio station, KBOO, that brought the best, most nuanced, most deeply understanding coverage of the events we've been discussing. When it comes to grassroots activism, to awareness of and response to racism, KBOO's role was and is critical. Here's Patricia again to remind us.
Did you know that hundreds of local radio activists have learned how to produce radio right here at KBOO and all for free? KBOO is a vibrant radio community that gives voice to a great diversity of folks in the Portland area. To support our work, you can go to kboo.fm/give, text KBOO to 44321, or click on the donate button on your KBOO app. The KBOO community thanks you for your support.
Before the fund drive pitch, I was talking with Eleanor Langer, author of 100 Little Hitlers, The Death of a Black Man, The Trial of a White Racist, and The Rise of the Neo-Nazi Movement in America. We talked in particular about racism in Portland, then and now, and the way that the legal system's response to the murder of Mulugeta Serra seemed to absolve Portland and Portlanders from any responsibility. We began that conversation by discussing how Eleanor's book treated the homegrown skinhead racists as human beings rather than stick figures, the better to understand them. Let's turn now to her very human treatment of Mulugeta Sirah himself, the Ethiopian immigrant murdered by the racist skinheads. This is what she wrote in the Oregon Encyclopedia.
Near Laurelhurst Park in the city of Portland, above the street signs at Southeast 31st and Pine, is a two-sided topper featuring the smiling face of the young Ethiopian immigrant Mulugeta Sirah, killed there in a confrontation with racist skinheads in the early hours of November 13, 1988. The topper, written in both English and Amharic, is one of 17 in the immediate area installed through the efforts of the Portland Urban League, Southeast Uplift, the Office of Community and Civic Affairs, the Kearns Neighborhood Association, and the Portland Bureau of Transportation. Unveiled in a public ceremony on November 13, 2018, the Zone of Remembrance is a tribute to an otherwise inconspicuous person whose killing made him a symbol of the rise of the white supremacist movement in the United States, as well as the opposition to it. But it is important to remember that before he became a public symbol, he was a man. Born on October 21, 1960, Mulugeta Sirah began his life in a farming hamlet in the Ethiopian highlands. He moved to Addis Ababa in the 1970s to attend high school, following in the footsteps of an uncle, Engada Berhanu, who had studied there before moving to the United States in 1973. Berhanu had planned to complete his undergraduate studies and return to Ethiopia, but with the overthrow of Emperor Haile Selassie in 1974, in the subsequent civil war, he could not go home. Instead, he settled in Portland, where he obtained a master's degree in social work from Portland State. Living in Addis Ababa during the Red Terror, Mulugeta Sirah also dreamed of furthering his education in the United States. In November 1980, he arrived in Oregon and moved in with his uncle in an apartment in Beaverton. He began business and engineering classes at PCC and worked at a succession of jobs. When Berhanu moved to California to begin his career, Sirah stayed on, a welcome member of Portland's growing Ethiopian exile community. In the fall of 1988, Sirah was working as an airport bus driver and sharing an apartment at 212 Southeast 31st. Next to it, on Pine, was an apartment frequented by white supremacists associated with Eastside White Pride. At about 1 in the morning on November 13th, as Sirah was being dropped off after a party, three skinheads and their girlfriends piled into their car at the southwest corner of Southeast Pine and turned onto Southeast 31st, where Mulugeta and his Ethiopian friends were talking in their car. Blocked, the skinheads began honking and shouting. When they realized that the people in the other car were black, they shouted racist slurs. Undoubtedly trying to stop an assault, Sirah got out of the car and walked toward his apartment, gesturing to the others to settle down, but it did not stop. As the men flew out from both cars and began to fight, he turned back from his door and ran down the street to help his friends. Within minutes, his head was smashed by one of the skinheads wielding a bat. Soon he was dead. The three skinheads later pleaded guilty, one to murder and two to manslaughter, and went to prison. While the life of the man was over, the life of the symbol was just beginning. Mulugeta Sirah was a modest man from a troubled country, seeking to finish his education in the United States, and he would doubtless be surprised by his renown. He was buried beneath a simple stone in Portland's Riverview Cemetery, surrounded by the Portlanders of his adopted home.
Thank you, Eleanor. Given what's going on in Gaza, I want to leave you with this poem. It's by Deborah Major, poet laureate of San Francisco, and she calls it Childhoods Remembered. Do you remember holding your small child hand up to your father's large comforting hand, amazed at its size compared to your vine-thin fingers? Do you remember making fingers and palms into church and steeple, and then opening to see all the people? Do you remember drawing eyes and mouths on fingers, creating silly finger people? Thumb folded around, pointer finger, making a mouth, opening and closing. Silly games of childhood, laughter crawling down our bodies, dissolving in the air and reappearing as a tickle giggle, finger wiggle. Remember? Not wanting to be one of the missing, or one of the unable to be identified, killed. The little girl wrote on the inside of her heart-shaped palm, between heart and lifelines, in neat Arabic script, "If my hand survived, this is my name," before she was slain. These children do not have numbers burned into their arms, but many have written their own names, statements, and identification numbers. Pants legs rolled up reveal the brother's inscribed legs, reading Ahmad Natil, Joan Natil, Rebhan Natil. Did the oldest write it for his younger brothers? Or were they perhaps written by a trembling mother or a father writing while damning his own tears? Now they lie next to each other, softly brown saplings chopped down before they could bear fruit. The whole family, it seems, assassinated in what their killers call a cleansing, a mowing of grass, a righteous final solution. And that is our program today. With tremendous thanks to our guests, Eleanor Langer and Julianne Hauschultz, to Old Moles Jan Hawken and Patricia Kohlberg, and to the staff at KABU that makes all this possible. We're in our end-of-the-year fund drive. Any contribution you can make will be matched dollar for dollar by a generous group of donors. For the last word, here's Patricia.
Before we go, I want to remind you one last time that KABU is now in our winter fund drive, and we need your support. It takes more than dedication and hard work to keep the station on the air. If you can, please take a moment to donate to KABU, or better yet, become a monthly sustainer. You can do all this by going to kboo.fm/give, text KBOO to 44321, or click on the donate button on your KABU app. The KABU community thanks you.